Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Gloria Steinem, who's one of the United States' most influential feminists for more than three decades after founding Ms. Magazine. She's an activist, writer, and travels nationally and internationally and speaks about gender, race, and civil rights. She's the author of numerous books, including Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, Revolution from Within, and Moving Beyond Words. She's also the co-founder of the Women's Media Center, and this week she had an op-ed in the New York Times regarding the issues of race and gender that arise from the competition between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nomination. And we'll also go to Israel and speak with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, and he's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. Gideon Levy's writing has been praised for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli, as well as the Palestinian political landscape. He's also been recently covering President Bush's diplomatic mission to Israel. Of course, President Bush is now in Kuwait, and he's been in Abu Dhabi, where he met with some of the sailors from the American warships who had a disputed incident between these warships and the Iranian speedboats, which we'll talk about in the second hour with Risa Ehrlich. We'll also, in the second hour, talk with Alex Gibney, the Emmy and Grammy Award-winning director and film producer, whose film Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, was nominated for the Academy Award in 2006. His new film we were talking about is Taxi to the Dark Side, which focuses on an innocent taxi driver in Afghanistan who was tortured and killed in U.S. custody in 2002. And in the second hour, towards the end, we'll go back to Kenya and get an update on the situation there, which does not appear to be improving. Also, I forgot to mention Mark Schmidt will be joining us in the first hour. In the last segment, he's a frequent contributor to the widely read blog Talking Points Memo, and he served for 7 years in the U.S. Senate as a speechwriter, and later as the policy director for Senator Bill Bradley. He's also a senior policy advisor to Bradley's 2000 presidential campaign. We'll get an overview of the full campaign from him. I'm now speaking with Gloria Steinem, who is the United States' most influential feminist more than three decades after founding Ms. Magazine. She's an activist and writer and travels nationally and internationally and speaks about gender, race, and civil rights issues. She's also the author of numerous books, including Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, Revolution from Within, and Moving Beyond Words. She's also the co-founder of the Women's Media Center and had an op-ed published this week in the New York Times regarding the issues of race and gender that arise from the competition between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. And, of course, in Sunday's New York Times, there's a front-page story in the Week in Review about the history of race and gender in terms of who is emancipated and in what order in this country. There's a picture of you here, Gloria, with Bella Abzug and Jesse Jackson. And I guess the point that you're trying to make and that you made in your op-ed in the New York Times this week is that you don't want the debate between Hillary and Clinton and Barack Obama to turn unhealthy, and you suspect that the press would like it to be more of a slugfest.
That's true. That's an understatement. I'm really worried about the impulse to think that that only conflict is news, and so the degree to which they share issues, which is 90% of the time voting in the Senate when the conditions were the same and the issues were the same, and share values and share an interest in a coalition that can elect one of them, really gets lost. So I'm hoping that we can understand that the sexual caste system and the racial caste system are intertwined. They can't be separated. We have to struggle with them and extricate them and free ourselves together.
Well, it does seem that based upon the reaction to Bill Clinton's remark up in New Hampshire, referring to Barack Obama's record on authorizing and voting for the Iraq War as being very similar to his wife's, and he referred to it as a fairy tale. And then her subsequent remarks about President Johnson's contribution with the Civil Rights Act of 1965, finally getting rid of 100 years of Jim Crow, though they have been blown out of proportions, I think, by any reasonable standards, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're talking about process, and one ought to be able to talk about process. I think perhaps Hillary Clinton should have pointed out that LBJ wouldn't ever have moved a finger if it hadn't been for the public pressure brought about by the civil rights movement. So it isn't as if, I mean, there was a sequence of events there. But I'm hoping that the fact that there are good people who know each other inside all of the campaigns, including the Edwards campaign, can exert some influence from within, and that we can try to keep pointing out when the press is treating them unequally. And actually, that was what caused me to write the op-ed page piece, because it seemed to me that when Obama talked about the civil rights confrontations of the past, he was seen as uniting. And when Hillary Clinton talked about the old boys club and named discrimination, she was seen as divisive. There seemed to be a really double standard in the press. So I was trying to make the point that they're pretty much the same. The problem is that the press treats them differently and takes sex discrimination and racial discrimination with differing degrees of seriousness.
But it seems to me that at the end of the day, it's sort of a no-brainer that one way or the other, one of these two is probably going to be the president and the vice president. And I have a feeling that this year, that in spite of efforts on the press to make it more contentious, that whoever wins and whoever loses on the Democratic side are going to work together, because they detect within the ranks of the Democrats this extraordinary hunger to get political power back, to end and reverse the Bush regime. And I don't think anybody that's a Democrat wants to be anything but 100% aboard that effort.
No, I hope you're right. It's interesting, though, that you say that you think they could be a ticket together. I would think they're so much the same and representing not dissimilar, you know, major urban parts of the country, that Richardson might be the vice president for one of them.
Well, it's possible. I think that if I would see a Hillary Obama ticket as being a natural, but in Obama's case, if he were to win the nomination, he might be pressured to put somebody in with some national security credentials to make up for his lack of experience in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point too. Right.
But the broader point is that the Democrats are incredibly hungry this year. They're tasting victory and they don't want to blow it.
I think you're right, but I do think still the short news cycle goes for the conflict, and that was what was concerning me. And I notice it too. Of course, you know, all of us who are writers, and especially maybe well-socialized 1950s females, focus on the negative, not on the positive. But even though I got a huge amount of thanks for naming what people were thinking, which is that kind of magic moment that journalists occasionally can find, nonetheless, I can see in the persistent idea on the part of a few that what I was doing was trying to make a hierarchy of sex and race, as opposed to trying to say we can't have a hierarchy of sex and race. So in the response to my column, I also see that the kind of knee-jerk reaction is ranking, not linking.
Well, of course, your article refers to it, and certainly the article in Sunday's New York Times Week in Review does deal with the history of emancipation. And there's an interesting timeline here, isn't there?
There is, but even that article, you know, I've just skimmed it, but I believe that even that article does what most of them do, which is to give very short shrift to African-American women and to behave as if it's white women and black men, you know, which it isn't. You know, and if I were a part of any media empire right now, I would go out and find every African-American female pundit, commentator, analyst, expert, and put them on this campaign because they would uniquely, or at least they'd be statistically likely, to, based on their experience, to give much more in-depth and realistic coverage.
And of course, the context here is that that it took 50 years longer for women to get the vote than African American men.
Right.
Of course, that was delayed in the South for about 100 years by Jim Crow.
Yeah, and what I what was in that paragraph? Of course, you can only have 800 words. But what was in that paragraph too was explaining that because. Essentially, the movement for universal adult suffrage of African American women and men and white women was divided. Men vote first. The men suffered too, because what happened, of course, was that then they were denied the vote by poll taxes, by literacy tests that were ridiculous, and by outright. That might have been less likely. I think would have been less likely if white and black women had been going to the polls at the same time. So when we are divided, you know, it becomes a much greater problem for everybody.
So you've been digging up the contentious history then between Frederick Douglass and the women's rights pioneer Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Is not that edifying? I mean, the quotes here are,
died, he was mourned as a great suffragist on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, he basically was an ally. If he had any problem, as you can see by the statement that's quoted in that piece,
right.
Which is, essentially, show me, when there are your children are killed and murdered. He goes on into a litany of the suffering of black men and never once seems to notice that black women suffered the same thing.
Well, it's an extremely obvious point that you're making. I guess in many ways, we'd like to hear from African American women to point out this stupidity.
Read Patricia Williams in the Nation, who's brilliant, or go to the Women's Media website and read Carol Jenkins, who's got an essay up now. Essentially saying that, so where is the black girl in this? She's saying, hey, wait a minute. It's a brilliant little essay.
Well, Gloria Steinem, in the broader sense, though, one of the battles, I guess, that's going on here between Hillary and Obama is over the women's vote, and it will. And in South Carolina, coming up in weeks or so after the caucuses in Nevada, there Hillary and Barack Obama will be competing for the African American vote,
and Edwards too. Edwards is quite good on most of the issues of special concern to women, which is a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing that we have three candidates who are paying attention.
So what would your analysis be then of what happened in Iowa, where it appears that Obama got a lot of young women to vote for him, whereas older women between 50 and 60 disproportionately supported Senator Clinton, which I think was also true in New Hampshire, except she seemed to have more appeal across a broader appeal. So what would your...
Well, I think it's quite simple. You have to experience something to know that it exists. And if young women have a problem, it's only that they don't know yet how deep the problem is because they haven't been in the labor force long enough or had children and discovered who raises them and who doesn't or, discovered the differential discrimination when women age versus men age.
And take abortion for granted.
I think they're quite with it on all those issues because whether or not they take legal abortion for granted, they are extremely angry about the lack of sex education in the schools, about pharmacists who can refuse to give you contraceptive prescriptions. They're quite angry about that. But I think the reason why this is a terrible generalization because actually there are lots and lots of very activist young women, but in a kind of very general cultural way, women do get more radical with age. So you do see that reflected in the leadership of the suffrage movement and the leadership of the women's movement now, and in the voting patterns.
Yeah, you say that this Iowa and New Hampshire proved once again that women are the one group that grows more radical with age.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of, you know, it's no. I'm wary of generalizations, but it is. You can see it. You know, you can see that kind of pattern. The other thing I'm curious about, maybe you've heard it more than I have, is that people kept telling me on the phone, and yet I haven't seen any evidence of it, that in Iowa, Republicans were crossing over to vote for Obama because they considered him more beatable than Hillary. Have you heard that?
I've heard that. In fact, last week I had John Dean on the program, who really has made a career, if you will, out of being a recovering Republican and has written a number of books looking into the nature of the Republican Revolution and how detrimental it has been, particularly to the law and in this country. And he, I think, is a pretty astute observer of his party. And he suggested that with George Will and David Brooks continually and Bill Kristol continually singing Obama's praises, and all the Republican candidates all sort of wrapping themselves in his mantle, if you will, that John Dean was extremely suspicious that the Republicans were really wanted to run against Obama mm-hmm. and not against Hillary. That was a sort
I think I wonder if that's true. I mean, that's not Obama's fault if it's true,
no.
but I think it would be important to know, and I suspect we would need somebody to come forward and confess in order to know for sure.
Well, that's the thing, you know, that wherever it's open, these open primaries, the Republicans could if I was a Republican, I wouldn't be too thrilled about voting for the slate that they've got. I mean, this party, Obama and Clinton are talking about the 21st century, Republicans are all wanting to go back to the 80s, and they're running.
80s, it's more like the 1680s. Or
well, they're all sort of talking about Ronald Reagan and literally trying to ride in on his coattails. And as far as I know, he was the 80s, you know. So it's an extraordinary piece of atavism there that seems to have captured the Republican
party. What happened to the story of Huckabee's newsletter? Did you catch that, you know, that there were newsletters going out under his name in the past that were really very racist. But not signed by him, I hate to add, but going out under his name.
Right. I think it was Ron Paul, not Huckabee, that was the recipient of that.
Good. I can always count on you, Ian, to know everything about politics and not to put anything inaccurate out on the airwaves. Thank you very much.
Well, there's no question that the Republican establishment are absolutely apoplectic about the rise of Huckabee. I sort of see it as a sort of upstairs-downstairs scenario where the corporatists are quite happy to have the religious right lick the stamps and go out to the precincts and bring the votes in, but they want to keep them at arm's length. And now the people downstairs in the kitchen are now storming the palace.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it as a class issue.
Well, he's an economic populist, and you'll notice that there's a tremendous gap between Huckabee and the traditional spokespeople for the religious right, the big megachurch guys like the late Falwell and Robertson. They are deeply opposed to Huckabee, even though he's one of their brethren, because they are essentially a front for right-wing politics, and particularly
mm-hmm.
right-wing economic politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the Club for Growth is spending a fortune trying to get rid of Huckabee.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about our Mayor Bloomberg? Do you think he will or should come in?
Well, if he does, it'll be to the detriment of the Democrats. He will probably do to the Democrats what Perot did to the Republicans in 1992.
No, that's certainly true. I thought it was interesting that he was quoted as saying, I didn't see him saying this, that if it were Barack Obama as the candidate, he would not come in because he didn't wish to run against the first black president or the first black candidate. But if it were Hillary Clinton, he would.
Right.
But, well, wait a minute. What do we chop liver? The first word.
No, that's yes. The other explanation that's been attributed to him is that if anybody but McCain gets the Republican nomination, he'd step in.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, But either way, it seems that he will prevent the Republicans from having... I mean, if the Democrats can give disaffected Republicans a home in this 08 election, I think the Democrats will sweep in. But, you know, a lot of traditional Republicans just find it incredibly difficult to vote Democrat. So it's a question of who can entice them. And on the other hand, if he steps in, Bloomberg, he might give them a safety zone, if you know. So.
Well, I think, though, that female Republicans are sometimes more likely, at least in a proportionate sense, to vote Democratic. And I think women in general are less likely to be loyal to party labels. As a friend of mine who's an actor once said to me, I've been married to one Marxist and one fascist, and neither one took the garbage out. You know, so I think I think we're less likely to feel loyalty to labels that haven't really included us anyway.
Well, just in closing, Gloria Steinem, given the very, very established polling in this country makes it clear that by and large men in this country vote Republican and women vote Democrat. If you take that as a baseline, then obviously there's no, you know, in terms of pure tactics, there's no net gain running a woman on the Democratic side. But it's obviously history could be made here. So what do you think is at the heart of any resistance to breaking this ceiling, which I would think that most people would want to celebrate rather than be afraid of?
Yes, I mean, if we ever needed proof that eliminating leadership possibilities based on sex and race and family and class and famous fathers and so on is a problem for the country, George Bush has certainly, you know, given it to us. So it would be good for all of us to widen the leadership pool. I think just maybe I'm too in love with history, but just based on history, I would think that it would be easier to accept male leadership than female leadership, if only because we are mostly still raised by women and we associate female authority with childhood and tend to think it's not so appropriate in public life as in private life, and that's sometimes true for women as well as men. So I had named the piece that was in the New York Times my title, which of course writers' titles never get used, was a Short History of Change. And because that has been the pattern of change, I would guess that Obama would be the candidate. But I've never been good at predicting, so I don't know, but somehow the historical pattern seems quite strong.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Gloria Steinem.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Gloria Steinem, who is co-founder of the Women's Media Center, and she had an op-ed piece this week in the New York Times discussing the issues of race and gender that have arisen from the competition between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. Let's now go to Israel. I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, and he's a former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and his writing is being praised for its analysis and insight and understanding of Israeli as well as Palestinian perspectives. He's been covering President Bush's diplomatic mission to Israel, and prior to which you wrote, Gideon Levy, that I think with some tinge of embarrassment that Israel is one of the few places in the world where this president is welcome. You also said that the Middle East has moved further away from peace during Bush's tenure, and this belated and feeble attempt to change the facts on the ground will not produce anything. Has it produced anything?
No, unfortunately, nothing. The Middle East was in the last 7 years, the years of President Bush, just in a stage of getting far and far from peace. Unfortunately, the president did not show any involvement all those years. And now it's too little and too late.
And does that mean that this week's trip was just photo opportunities? We had a front page on the Los Angeles Times picture of Olmert giving Bush a GPS device for his mountain bike. Is that about the level of accomplishment?
I think it was one of the biggest climax of the visit. It's really a president who is just getting out of office and a prime minister who is struggling for survival. This is not a good matchup for making real courageous steps. And I didn't get the impression that President Bush really meant to do something. It's all talkings now. They are talking about the possibility to get to a peace treaty between Palestinian Israelis within a year. Let's say that they will achieve it. It will remain another document in a long, long history of peace documents between the Palestinians and Israelis, because nobody, including President Bush, does not mean to implement anything of it. So, you know, another document on the shelter is very nice to have, but on the ground, unfortunately, nothing will change.
And if this document is to be generated within the next year or this year, I understand that Olmert's political fortunes could get even worse. I mean, he's way down in the polls at any rate. But the Winograd report, isn't there a second stage of the Winograd report into the war last year against Lebanon?
Absolutely, yes. And this is going to be published on the 30th of this month, by the end of this month. But most of us believe that he will be able to survive it. Nobody knows what will be written there, but the assumption is that he will be able to survive it, as he survived the first report. But you see, the question is not about survival. The question is about taking measures. And here I am very skeptical.
And Gideon Levy, you've been also writing about the incidents against Palestinians. You profile the beating of a shepherd by a group of young settlers. I believe they came from an illegal settlement. Where does that situation stand? Not that the United States is putting any real pressure on. Rhetorically, President Bush said that there shouldn't be any territorial expansion and there has to be a Palestinian homeland at some point in the future. But give us a sense from the Israeli perspective of whether or not there is a movement within the broader political body of Israeli politics to stop the settlements, particularly these illegal ones.
First of all, according to the international law, you can't make this division between legal and illegal. They are all illegal, if to refer to the international law. A settlement in an occupied territory is illegal, period. So this division between illegal and legal is by itself a very problematic one. But I still remember days in which the Israeli government was scared to build one building in the occupied territories because they were always so afraid from the American administration's reaction. Those days are far away, and Israel got really a carte blanche to continue the settlement project. And the settlement project is continuing, even now when we are speaking. It is expanding, all the time expanding, legally and illegally, with the support of the government or without it. If you go to the occupied territories, you will see from week to week, from month to month, from year to year, more and more settlements and less perspective for peace.
And when did this long-standing American refusal to allow settlements, and therefore, as you've mentioned, the Israeli government were nervous about even putting up one building, when did the pressure from the United States cease?
It was never strong enough, because the matter of fact is that the settlement project never really stopped. I just remember times like in the reassessment period when James Baker was Secretary of State, and other periods in which Israel was much more cautious. In the last years, there's even not a reason to apologize or to explain. You see, about those illegal outposts, it's already two Israeli governments who were committed to evacuate them, and they were committed toward the American administration to evacuate them. And, you know, nothing happened, not with the former government and not with this government. The illegal so-called settlements are all there. I just came now back from the West Bank. I could see some of them. You know, talking is one thing, and the situation on the ground is entirely different.
Well, that leads one to assume, Gideon Levy, that there is a strategy behind this. What is the end game? I mean, does it really make the peace process look fraudulent?
No, I think the end game is not very clear to the right wing in Israel, but basically it is to prevent any chance of having a viable Palestinian state, or in other words, to prevent any kind of chance of a real just peace. And the American administration, I must tell you, is so passive that I tend to believe that in Washington they don't care so much if there will be peace or if there will not be peace, if this occupation will come to its end or it will not come to its end. The impression is that it's all about, saving face, but not really meaning to do something. I'm very sorry to say so.
Well, some analysts over here think that much of this is President Bush's gift to his hapless Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who needs something to leave office with. As you probably have noticed, her latest efforts in Pakistan, where she secretly brokered meetings between Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf, blew up in her face. They didn't ever protect Bhutto after getting her shoehorned in there. So she's looking pretty bad. Could you make the analysis that perhaps this is really to do with Bush and Rice wanting to have something that they can point to in the history books?
First of all, I wish it would have been true, because if something would have come out of it, and if it would be for their credit in the history books, it's fine with me. The problem is that, as I said, it's all too little and too late. And I have no doubt that Secretary Rice is the pusher. I think that Bush couldn't care less about peace in the Middle East. But even what she's doing and has been doing and will be doing in the remaining months seems, like something that really cannot lead to any meaningful achievement. The situation is so fragile, so explosive, and to sit now and to phrase, to formulate another document is really something which we witnessed so many times in the past. It becomes ridiculous.
So would you say that it's because of lack of progress and I guess a disingenuous attitude, as you point out, on the one hand, that perhaps the logic behind these settlements are to make a Palestinian state not viable, I wondered whether the external, broader Middle East situation has also had a negative effect, because President Bush's Iraq intervention has proven to be a catastrophe, from what I understand. It's put tremendous strain on the stability of the state of Jordan right next door, and it's by no means over in Iraq, and now we have the possibility of Pakistan unraveling. What's the opinion in the broader political debate in Israel about Bush's tenure in terms of the overall stability in the Middle East, not just the Palestinian-Israeli situation?
Yeah, as you can imagine yourself, you should separate between the view in Israel and my own personal view. Unfortunately, my view is not exactly the same like the majority's in Israel. I can tell you that the Middle East, after 7 years of George Bush, is a much more dangerous place, much more fragile place. Look at what happened in those years. We had one Palestinian entity, and now we have two. We have Gaza under an inhuman and terrible, terrible siege, with the Hamas leading Gaza. All bad news for peace, for the United States, and for Israel. And above all, I'm sorry to say so, but the United States is as hated as it's never been before in the Arab world, in Europe, in other places, in South America. This is all thanks to Mr. Bush. And I don't think that Americans should be very happy about being so hated. They also should ask themselves, why are we so hated all over the world? We, the leader of the free world, so-called. All this is a very, very poor balance for Bush's years.
So, Gideon, in contrast, you point out in your recent article in Haaretz that Bush is popular in Israel, and that the prime minister even has a portrait of him, of Bush, on his wall at home. What does that say? Why is Bush popular in Israel, given the analysis that you just presented? Even though you say you're a minority voice there, there's got to be some people who look at reality.
I truly believe, as I wrote, that Ehud Olmert is the only prime minister in the world who keeps now a huge portrait of George W. Bush in his living room. And I think that most of Israelis are satisfied from Bush because he gave Israel this carte blanche, this freedom to do whatever it wants. The problem is that, in my view, real friendship with Israel is pushing Israel to put an end to the occupation. This is real friendship. This is real care for the future of this state. And those who let Israel go wild are those who don't care about the future of Israel, because finally it will all explode in our faces.
And what is the Israeli interpretation of the presidential race here in the United States, with the likelihood of a Democrat winning the presidency? And it's obviously going to be either, or at least it seems to be either, Hillary Clinton or Obama. Is there any discussion in Israel that maybe a new American president will change the dynamics and put more pressure on Israel to reach an honest and workable solution?
As you can imagine yourself, Israelis, like the Jewish community in the United States, is a little nervous about Obama, which makes him a perfect candidate, in my view, or at least the best one that from the present list, he seems the only one who might make a change. So there is some kind of suspicion toward Obama in Israel, like in the Jewish community, and he, I understand, is trying hard to really change this impression.
Well, Gideon Levy, I have to tell you that it's more than suspicion. There are really very venal documents being circulated amongst conservative Jewish groups in this country, suggesting that Obama works in hand and glove with Osama bin Laden, and that he's some kind of secret Islamic terrorist, you know. I mean, there's some bizarre stuff that's out there now.
I hope, and I'm sure, that American people is much more intelligent than this. And I don't think that this kind of things people will buy. But who knows? I don't know much about Obama. I'm not sure that many people know. But we can only refer to what he said until now. And unfortunately or fortunately, I must tell you that history taught us that when they all get to the White House, they are more or less the same, with small, minor changes and differences. I must remind you that the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza is now continuing for 40 years. So many American presidents were in power. So many American presidents understood that this occupation must come to its end. And the occupation is now at its peak, yes? And nobody is really speaking seriously about putting an end to it, or nobody takes any measures. So we saw already so many presidents with better intention and less good intention. I'm sure, for example, that Clinton was with very good intentions. I think President Carter had very good intentions, but nothing came out of it. So I really think that it will not matter so much as people tend to think.
Well, just in closing, Gideon Levy, we're suggesting here that there will be a new kind of government and a new direction here in the United States, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Obama. But what's happening in Israel, I get the impression that Israel could move back to the right, that Netanyahu is in a strong position and Olmert is barely on life support.
Absolutely right. I think if there would have been elections today, Netanyahu would be back. All the polls shows it, and more than this, he is improving from month to month, from poll to poll. Yeah, this is part of this tragedy in this part of the world. The fact that Israeli public opinion is right-wing is a big obstacle, but it takes really a courageous leader to overcome it, because I truly believe that most of the Israelis, if they would have faced a real courageous leader who would really show them a chance, they would follow him. Right now, the mood is to be right-wing, especially after all the disappointments from Olmert and from Barak. So again, Netanyahu, who disappointed already the Israelis once, and who lost already once the elections after a very, very failing candidacy, but you know the reservoir of politicians in Israel is rather poor, so we always get back to the former ones.
Well, we have the Clintons and the Bushes over here.
So we still are in the generation of the fathers. We'll wait until Netanyahu's son will be grown up, and then maybe we'll vote for him.
Well, there's still a disconnect, though, isn't there, between the fact that the majority of Israelis, when they're polled, about 70% say they want peace with Palestine. On the other hand, you're saying that the country's moved to the right, and that's the dominant voting bloc.
Let me say something about this, because this is really the contradiction that must be explained. 70% of the Israelis say that they want peace with the Palestinians. 70% of the Israelis even say that they accept the idea of Palestinian state. But then you ask the Israelis about evacuating settlements, and then you see that the majority are opposing evacuating all the settlements, which is the only way to create a Palestinian state. So it's really a way to say things and not to mean to pay the price for them. And therefore, for me, it's empty words.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles this morning, Gideon Levy, and for giving us your analysis of President Bush's recent trip there.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist who writes for Haaretz, and he's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, the former Israeli prime minister and foreign minister. Gideon Levy's writing has been praised for its keen analysis, insight, and understanding of the Israeli as well as the Palestinian perspectives and issues. And we were talking then about President Bush's diplomatic mission this week to Israel that continues into the Gulf at the moment. I'm now speaking with Mark Schmidt, who's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation with expertise in American politics and specializing in developing new approaches to finding a balance between money and expression in the political process. He is a noted voice on reform of the political process and has has been an authority on campaign finance and congressional procedures. He's a frequent contributor to the widely read blog Talking Points Memo. And Mark Schmidt served for seven years in the United States Senate as a speechwriter and later as a policy director to Senator Bill Bradley. He was also Senator Bill Bradley's senior policy advisor for his 2000 presidential campaign. And Mark, it's we were speaking earlier with Gloria Steinem, who was suggesting that what needs to be avoided in the contest between Obama and Hillary Clinton is not to be sort of perhaps encouraged to get to take the gloves off and get into a real scrap, which would be detrimental, but perhaps something that the press want. Do you think the press is ginning up tensions between those and disputes between those two candidates that are largely being overblown?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Ian.
It's a pleasure.
I don't think the press is ginning it up, but I think the fact that we have so many outlets now, so much of the press that's looking at the other press that's kind of circling around itself. So that you have the Politico and the Huffington Post, and you have all these things, which are all great. I mean, I love them. I contribute to some of them and so forth. But there's so much content that anything can quickly be kind of bounce around across all these different sources and kind of get blown up to amazing proportions. So you see a little thing like what I think is a little thing. Some of the you know, slightly racialized comments that have been made all of a sudden explode over the course of 2 days to the point that that's half of what Senator Clinton had to talk about on Meet the Press. So I think this echo chamber effect has a little of it, whether journalists are willfully ginning up the conflicts or not. But, you know, conflict is a part of politics. I don't want to avoid conflict at all. So to the extent that there are disagreements among these candidates, they should be straightforward about it. And I think that on some of these issues, some of the issues here actually do go to the conflict between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, for example, because Senator Clinton was making the point that inspiration is nice, but it's more important to have a certain kind of experienced leadership. That's what she was saying in the course of those remarks about Martin Luther King and JFK and LBJ and so forth, and that's her argument. And Senator Obama's argument is, you know, we're ready for a fresh start here. That's the essence of their campaign against each other. It's not differences of opinion on particular issues. So I don't see it's not a bad thing that those conflicts come out.
Well, I don't think, though, that the Democratic base and Democratic activists have much of a stomach for conflict. I think they're so hungry to win this time that they'd like it to go away.
Well, I think so, but I think that the specific conflict right now between all three of them, you know, I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago where I talked about this as a theory of change election. The competition between Clinton and Obama and Edwards is about that each one has a different idea, not just of how they're going to win the presidency, but how they are then going to change the country. And it's not what they're going to do, it's how they're going to do it that they're disagreeing about. And I think Democratic voters need to hear all sides of that argument, because it's actually a very complicated and fascinating argument between Senator Edwards, who says, you know, people with power and money never back down unless you demand change, Senator Clinton, who says it's hard work, it's experience, I know how to get these things done, and Senator Obama, who's basically saying it's about a whole different approach to politics that can draw in independents and some Republicans and then build a different kind of coalition. Those are three different arguments, and that's the essence of how I would decide who to vote for, in fact. It's not that this one's health care plan is slightly better than the other ones.
Well, I've detected a certain historical atavism here, where several, in fact, the entire Republican field running for president seemed to be frozen in the 1980s. They're all running on Ronald Reagan's coattails. Right. To some extent, Hillary is harking back to the 90s, promising a rerun of the 90s. Obama, of course, is pretty much in the 21st century.
Right.
you made an argument in the American Prospect recently, Mark Schmidt, that that both the Democrats and the Republicans are nostalgic for the 1950s, the difference being that Republicans want to go home to the United States of the 1950s, while the Democrats want the jobs that they had back in the 1950s.
Right. And I borrowed that line from Brink Lindsey, who's a libertarian writer at the Cato Institute. So I the rest of the column is my own, but that particular line I credited to to Brink. And I was noticing the kind of nostalgia for the 1950s that was suddenly present in a lot of, not just the presidential candidates, but a lot of writers like Paul Krugman writing about the economy and basically using the 50s to say we had a time when we had broadly shared prosperity and
the American dream was working.
American dream was working. You could work in a factory and have own a big house and have a large family and so forth. And I think it's funny that a lot of the people making this argument were people who grew up in the 50s or the 60s and kind of spent their youth in rebellion against that era because of the cultural constraints of that time. Suddenly getting nostalgic for it, and I also thought that the things that happened to be the case in the 1950s, we're not going to recreate those. We're not going to recreate a United States that had just won a world war in which every other country basically destroyed its industrial base. So it's kind of like we do have to figure out a new way to distribute. To handle shared prosperity, and I think it probably includes a somewhat larger role for government. I'm not sure any of the candidates on the Democratic side are quite there with understanding how different the arrangements maybe have to be between government and employers in order to make it possible to do health care and to really ensure that people who are working are able to get ahead. But they're getting there.
But all of these kind of atavistic nostalgia for the 50s forgets one salient thing, and that is that in the 50s, when we had Harriet and Ozzie and my three sons and the perfect nuclear family and the days of black and white television, what is missing from that is that the African Americans and Hispanics were invisible.
Right.
I mean, it's a completely different country.
It's a different
the United States
in a million ways.
2000.
And if you're African American, you don't have any nostalgia for the 1950s whatsoever, because you were. I mean, there were some in Detroit. The auto plants were integrated. There was beginnings of economic opportunity in the North for African Americans, but for the most part.
So what are the prospects for any of the Republicans, given that they're, as I say, they're marooned in the 1980s at best, even if their hearts are in the 1950s?
Right.
What's the only one of them that seems to have any connection to the voters and seems to be actually able to speak very, very simply and straightforwardly to the public, and I think is on a roll, and that, of course, is Mike Huckabee.
Right.
What's your analysis of the extent to which the corporate Republican elite, the K Street guys like Grover Norquist and the Club for Growth and these people, are spending a lot of money trying to defeat him?
Right.
Give us a sense of that particular battle within between the corporatists and the grassroots.
Right. Well, I think the basic, what Huckabee is offering is a kind of Republicanism that's always been out there that they've never taken advantage of, which is the language that says we're serious about families, we're serious social conservatives. That means not only do we oppose gay marriage and abortion and so forth, but we also understand that families need some supports to get ahead in the world, to stay together. You know, that it's economic pressures and things like that do more to break up families than anything else. He has a glimmer, the tiniest glimmer of recognition of that. He doesn't put any substance behind it. He has a tax proposal that would make it impossible to do any of that, but he sort of talks about it a little bit. And that is what that does is talk about broken families. That's a divorce between the social conservatism and economic libertarianism that has been the marriage that has held the Republican coalition together for a couple decades now. And if he breaks, they don't want to let him break that. Now, I've always been told that the Norquist and the Club for Growth and everything, they just hate Huckabee. You know, they will do anything to stop Huckabee, even going so far as to accept John McCain, who they also don't like. But at the same time, and we saw, at the beginning of the week or maybe the end of last week, we saw Bill Kristol, the new columnist for the New York Times, weigh in with his first column, which was basically to say, you know, Huckabee might be okay. Now, that's certainly the voice of a Republican establishment that's not the natural Huckabee base, and he's somebody who's supported Giuliani and McCain in the past. So I think you're beginning to see almost within the Republican establishment the split between those who are saying we've got to stop Huckabee at all costs and those who are saying, you know, the person who most connects with the voters might actually be our best nominee. Why not? And so I think there may be it may be that there's enough of that faction that says, well, we can maybe live with Huckabee, that they let it happen.
So just in closing, Mark, what would your handicap be on this, on the Democratic side and on the Republican side? Because we obviously South Carolina is going to be good to Huckabee and to Obama, probably. The caucuses in Nevada are being heavily fought over, where both candidates are trying to steal which labor movement they can grab. But obviously, I think the big day for Hillary will be February the 5th.
Right.
So, give us a brief sketch of where you think it's heading.
Well, I mean, we haven't talked about Senator McCain at all, who is certainly still
right.
a live candidate, and if he does well in Michigan, then there's a bit of a battle between McCain and Huckabee in South Carolina again, where McCain has always had some significant establishment support, for example, from Senator Lindsey Graham. Is a major supporter of his, and the governor, I think, is Governor Sanford, is currently undeclared, but had been a McCain supporter in the past. So that could be where McCain actually comes out ahead, especially if he does put away Romney in Michigan. And I look at Mitt Romney, and I can't believe anybody would vote for him. I understand why people vote for Huckabee. I understand why people voted for George Bush. I don't say that just as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I think we'll probably come down to a Huckabee McCain showdown, and I actually think Huckabee has some real advantages in that showdown, and as Kristol said, may actually be an okay candidate, not a disaster, not another Goldwater for the Republican Party, maybe. On the Democratic side, I think what's interesting is to see that after the victory in New Hampshire, so many endorsements have gone Obama's way. In a sense, the momentum out of Iowa kind of continued, but was tempered a little bit, which is good. And now those victories if he wins Nevada and South Carolina, both of which are expected, in a sense, those become comebacks for him, as opposed to just, you know, another stop on the trail and that Clinton could actually have kind of skipped over. So I do think it goes to February 5th, but I think that by the end of the by the time we come out of South Carolina, Obama will have regained some very significant momentum going into those states, and many of them are states, for example, California, where independents can vote. It's interesting, you know, in California, that the Democratic Party decided to let independents vote in its primary. The Republican Party didn't. So the Democratic primary is going to lead to a kind of more expansive
right.
opening
well,
we, up.
I'm afraid we've run out of time here.
I've asked you the question, and
I can't. We can't stay for the entire answer. I thank you so much for joining us
today. Okay, thank you for having me.
Again, I was speaking there with Mark Schmidt, Senior Fellow of the New American Foundation, writes on the widely read blog Talking Points Memo, and was Senator Bill Bradley's Senior Policy Advisor for his 2000 presidential campaign. And I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the assistant producers, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.